This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's talk about not guilty. What could possibly happen there if this jury finds Lindsay Clancy not guilty by lack of criminal responsibility? She doesn't walk out of the courtroom. She goes somewhere else. And the question everybody in the audience is asking is what somewhere else actually means for the woman who's already paralyzed, already in a hospital, and already on 24-hour S-watch. Under Massachusetts law, not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect verdict does not mean release. The court can order the defendant hospitalized for up to 40 days of observation. After that, the DA or hospital superintendent can petition for involuntary commitment. Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, is here with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. So what happens in the courtroom, Eric, the moment the verdict is read, if it is not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect? What happens to Lindsay at that moment?
Yeah, you know, Lindsay's not going home. She's not going home anytime soon. That's for darn sure. Either way, regardless of what the jury comes out with. So, you know, her supporters who might be outside the courthouse, they're not going to see her. It's not going to be something like that. Instead, she's going to go through that 40-day commitment at a psychiatric facility. They're going to assess whether – they're going to assess her dangerousness. And then after that, the DA can petition to continue the involuntary commitment. And that petition can be reevaluated every year. But it's also kind of an indefinite sentence into the psychiatric facility. So it could be forever. It could be a year and a half. There's such a wide range in terms of what this might look like in the coming years for Lindsay Clancy.
How much does this vary from state to state in as far as how they hold someone? Because just from experience and seeing other cases and just life, you know, psychiatric facilities, unless they're getting paid and your insurance is covering it, they don't necessarily want to keep you there unless they have no choice but to keep you there by law. How much or how willing, I guess, are facilities, and I guess it varies by facility, but state law too, to keep the person there? How often do you see folks? I mean, it's rare that anyone wins a defense of this sort of argument, but the ones that do, how often do they stay incarcerated or in a mental health facility indefinitely? I know Andrea Yates is still there because she wants to be. Different state, though. Different set of laws. Is that the same sort of thing everywhere, where if Lindsay Clancy is to say, keep me locked up here, I don't want to be out, that they would honor that? Or is it at some point, we think you're good enough to go? Because they do that all the time with 72-hour holds and things of that nature, where people are not good to go, but guess what? Insurance ain't covering the bill anymore, so enjoy the paper bag and the bridge down by the river. What are your thoughts?
Right. You know, we like to think that these determinations in terms of whether to let somebody out from a psychiatric facility after being found not guilty by reason of insanity are by the letter of the law. They're by the book. And hey, if you know, we look at these three things, and if they're met, we let them out. If they're not, we don't. The reality is much more complicated. There are other interests involved. There are funding interests. You know, to house a human being inside of a facility and make sure they're fed and, you know, don't die and things like that. So just like a normal prison, that costs tens of thousands per year per person. And they have thousands of, or not, if not more, people in these facilities. So when we add into that the level of care that might be required for somebody in Lindsay Clancy's situation, you better believe that facility might be looking at their books and they're like, gosh, we've got a funding issue. We've got monetary considerations here. Those things can creep into these determinations, whether it's talked about publicly or expressly or not.
So here are the numbers for Massachusetts, since I love looking at our numbers.
Yes.
In between. So this is for all individuals, not just filicide in cases like this for women that were convicted and not not.
Yes.
Yes. You know, so this is it. So this is for everyone, including males ever convicted. The shortest ever was for an older male for not criminally being responsible. The shortest ever was 3.5 years because he's older and had other issues going on. The average is about 16 years. And this is all people, not just women committed because of filicide. The shortest, I mean, I told you shortest and the longest was about 40. So she's looking at, based on this average in Massachusetts, at least about 15 years, 16 years, if she even wants to get at that point. So for those that say she's just going to walk free and go and have more babies. Now, we covered this yesterday as well. Remember, if you're looking at law of average, because some people are saying, well, she'll just get out, have more babies and do it again. No, because if we're looking at the average of 16 years, she'll be in the middle of, again,
she'll
pure speculation.
That,
past that point where she can have babies. Yeah. And so that won't be a concern. For those that were most concerned about her having babies and doing that again, no, it ain't going to happen.
Is there ever conditions on releases on things like this? If she is to again, we're just trying to play out all the possibilities here because everybody's thinking of them. Not guilty, goes to a facility. Are there conditions ever of, okay, well, you don't need to live in the facility anymore, but you can't have any more babies? And short of, you know, making that medically impossible, are there ever conditions of like, well, if you get pregnant, you're coming right back here, and then the baby's going to go to, you know, foster care or something? I mean, are things like that, do things like that exist, Eric?
Well, they do exist in some contexts. For example, if there was someone who was convicted of a gang shooting and they went to prison, then they're on parole. You have conditions of parole. You get to be out in the community, but there are things you can't do. For example, you can't associate with known gang members. You can't be their friend. You can't go to the movies with them. So those conditions have been determined lawful, whereas courts have determined other, sometimes more exotic and uncommon conditions unlawful. And I would venture to say that I don't think the government could prevent a person from trying to have a child if they were going to release her. I don't think they could say, hey, we'll let you out, but you cannot engage in this fundamental constitutional right of trying to procreate because we're worried something bad's going to happen. I think a judge would determine that might be cruel and unusual punishment. There might be a due process issue. I just would be very skeptical about such a condition and the lawfulness of it.
And actually, here's another practical aspect that I was just looking up. I asked the question, can she actually physically still have babies with being paralyzed from the waist down?
Sure.
Yes, possible, but it's a high-risk pregnancy. So she's got a higher risk of infections, blood clots, preterm labor, harder labor management. So she needs actually a specialized team of spinal care teams and obstetrics to actually manage that as well. So it's not impossible, but more improbable. As well as when you throw the legal issues on top of that, restrictions, the fact that the likelihood of her getting out, and then this is if she's not guilty by reason of sanity, likelihood of at least 16 years, if not longer, if by either her choice or the state's choice, I think it's really kind of a moot point.
Yeah. I mean, as far as advocacy goes for her, depending on where she ends up, obviously she has family. They've been standing behind her in court, so I would assume that they're still going to be there to an extent after, no matter where she goes. But is that, how key is that to any sort of, I don't know if treatment is the right word, or care, maybe more of the operative word, the care that she's going to get. How important is that she has people advocating for her care and her well-being versus just everyone abandoning her and saying, good luck with the system?
It is a critical piece to whether she would be released later if she is committed to a psychiatric facility, because she can petition every year in Massachusetts to try to get out. And when she does, what initially mental health folks will determine, and then perhaps a court might ultimately decide, is whether the level of dangerousness that she might have if she is let out. And it's just common sense that if a person has a pro-social support system, has people looking out for them, has a place to go, has a place to live, people who might feed her, people who might care for her, considering her physical disabilities and her mental health issues as well. That would make the fact finder much more inclined to say, hey, this person is less likely to be dangerous than someone who, if we let them out, you know, they're going under a bridge somewhere and God knows what happens after that.
Yeah. I mean, someone like her, there's high probability of abuse behind bars. There's high probability of abuse in a mental institution as well. It happens, unfortunately. I mean, so that's another thing that she's going to have to contend with. I mean, none of this is a great path for Lindsay Glancy. I mean, it's very much all, it's restrictive as it needs to be, based on what the jury is going to decide.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
What happens, though, if she is found guilty? What kind of appeals are available to her? And can she survive them, quite literally? Yeah. That's what we're about to get into as we continue our conversation here. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, and Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor. If this jury finds Lindsay Clancy guilty of first-degree murder, the sentence is automatic, life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge reads it, it's done. But the case doesn't end when the sentence is read. In Massachusetts, a first-degree murder conviction triggers an automatic appeal to the Supreme Judicial Court. Reddington doesn't have to really do much. The case goes up on its own. Eric, that's a good legal question. What does that automatic review actually look for? And I guess how often does anything get changed on automatic review? Or does it take a lot of advocacy from attorneys to get the Supreme Court to go, wait a second, we don't think that this is how it should have ended?
You know, automatic reviews can, unfortunately, just be folks going through the motions.
Yeah.
They've got to do this review, but we know what happened at trial, and they are probably not going to disturb what is the standard consequence for someone who's convicted of first-degree murder. So, and on top of that, gosh, you think about the conditions for a person like Lindsay Clancy inside of there. It's not that I like feel terribly bad for her. This is just a horrible situation all around. But we don't want a person unduly suffering in there. And a person who's dealing with paralysis, that's hard enough in normal everyday life outside of the prison. Think about how tough it'd be in a prison.
Yeah. And what do you think is going to be – I mean, Reddington objected many times, which gave him the jump board for an appeal in those areas. Out of all the areas he objected in, what do you think is going to be the first one he's going to use on the attack for an appeal process? Do you think has the biggest teeth? And is that what you do? Do you take the biggest one first and go with that?
Well, you've got to bring every possible potential outcome of being able to prevail on an appeal. But one thing, Robin and Tony, that we talked about last week and that really struck me as improper was the prosecution's question that to a Lindsay Clancy family member, you know, is killing your kid a mortal sin under, you know, Christian doctrine? I can't think of a more improper question that injects ideas of moral judgment, religious judgment, and how that could affect a jury. That is my first argument I'm making on appeal, is that that was wholly improper. It tainted how the jury is going to see this in such an egregious fashion that we've got to do this all over now. I think the prosecution totally screwed up on that.
And what the craziest set of circumstances, the prosecution asked the question, then the later witness said it himself, which was double down dumb. I mean, it just they've really hurt themselves on that one. So what do you think the probability of that being a success? I mean, I'm not saying 100% or anything like that. I mean, is that weighted? Do you think that's going to go well for the defense on that one, or prosecution's going to win it?
I really think they have some significant traction on that potential appeal if there is a conviction. You can't get into these jurors' minds like, oh, if you don't convict this person, God's going to be mad at you. I can't think of a more improper admission in a trial.
But, I mean, it wasn't – they didn't go to the jury and say, if you convict her, she's – I mean, it was directed to the witness by the attorney. There was that one, which I completely agree with everything you just said, Eric. But then later on, and I failed off the top of my head to remember exactly which doctor it was that was testifying. Maybe someone can tell me, who also brought up mortal sin. That was in a different context. And I'm curious to get your take on that, because when it was brought up a second time, number one, it told me, oh, that's where they got the word mortal sin from. They took it from the testimony they knew that was going to come up from their witness shortly down the line, and let me grab that and insert it over here because it's somehow going to support this. I think it was a horrible call, but I think that's probably where the word came from. Then you get to the doctor who was talking to her about her, trying to understand where she was coming from, and asked about her faith, asked about, you know, trying to get a full psychological picture of how this woman functions. And in that context, that doctor did ask her, essentially, you know, do you understand that murder is a mortal sin? Now, in that context, when you're trying to understand someone psychologically, their belief systems, what's going to inspire them this way and that, I think it's a fair question to ask, not because you're preaching to them or telling them that you realize this is a mortal sin and you're going to go to hell for it, but more so, is that the bearings that you were putting on the weight of your actions while you were taking, or while you were executing them, basically?
And that was Dr. Kirk Heilbrun.
Yeah. So was that a different context? Because, I mean, the judge shut that one down, too. But to me, as a layperson, it read a little different than the way the first time it was brought out by the attorney. Eric?
You know, I think it's a critical nuance, because whether Lindsay Clancy's family member thinks this alleged act was a mortal sin is not relevant at all. The jury in determining whether Lindsay Clancy is guilty shouldn't give a shit whether a family member thinks it's a mortal sin. On the other hand, whether Lindsay Clancy thinks it's a mortal sin, that is relevant. And it goes to her ability to appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct. Gosh, if she was a devout Christian and she's talking to this doctor and her response is, yes, I think it was a mortal sin. And I thought that at the time, and that went through my head, God, what's God going to think about this? That is much more relevant to the jury deciding whether she can appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct than some family member's opinion as to whether something's a mortal sin. So, yeah, there's a big difference there.
Yeah, I mean,
and I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was wondering how much, you know, should that have been shut down? Should that not have been allowed to be discussed in court the way that it was? Because again, I almost felt, look, I'm not on the side here of, you know, lock her up forever. I think she needs mental health help. But I just felt like, yeah, I mean, I think I understood where that doctor was going. Should that have been shut down, or was that improperly, you know, was that a little quick to slam on the brakes because the word had been brought up again and it had just been brought out the day before, or a couple days before?
You know, in a trial where there is not an allegation of lack of criminal responsibility, in any other trial, it would be wholly improper if a detective was asking a murder suspect, hey, don't you think it's a mortal sin because you shot this gang member? Completely improper. In this case, though, what is central to the jury's consideration is her whether she can appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct. Does that necessarily implicate these larger moral codes such as spirituality, such as Christianity? And thus, does that make that kind of fair game to talk about if you're trying to get at, how do we determine if she appreciates the wrongfulness of her conduct? Well, perhaps it is through this lens of religious doctrine. And so I think that is more more so fair game than any other such reference.
Yeah, because the mortal sin was not brought up as a context for overall humanity. It was brought up in the context of a specific religion, Catholicism. And I think that's what actually, when it zeroed in on the specificity of that religion, I think that's what might have been the trigger. And then actually, when the mortal sin was brought up again, is able to be referenced. And so that's why I think Reddington's going to object to anything, yeah, obviously close to that for his own benefit and the benefit of defense.
Sure,
but
sure.
I think it was because the original religious connotation with it, not yeah, just as the overall arching.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. I mean, you can, I mean, can the jury look at this and go, okay, she understood that morally and ethically and by law, it's wrong to murder somebody in that moment. But because of the way her brain was working, whether it's psychosis or bipolar, whatever it is that is not letting her operate on full cylinder, and she was operating more so on, you know, for lack of a better term, some sort of a fucked up, you know, demented spiritual level of go to God and I'm going to leave this earth too, and then my babies are going to be coming with me. I mean, that to a lot of people, the spiritual world, God, you know, will his rules override the rules of the land, if you will. So you could, I mean, depending on how you're looking at it, look at this and appreciate the wrongfulness of your actions, but fully believe that what you're doing, those actions, you know, these rules on the land don't matter because I'm operating on this higher level right now, which she did appear to think she was doing.
All right. It's complicated. So if the jury concludes that she, like, let's just say hypothetically that they thought that she believed this was a mortal sin at the time, that this is bad, you can't do this, this is morally wrong at the time, that's a problem for the defense. However, if they then take it a step further and say, you know, she thought God was essentially directing her to do this, thereby giving her some kind of pass, some kind of way to sidestep this moral culpability that is the general rule, because if God's directly speaking to you saying, hey, no, that actually is okay, then she's not really appreciating the wrongfulness of her conduct. She doesn't think it's wrong. She thinks it's being directed by her, you know, supreme spiritual being. So it gets pretty complicated.
It does. I mean, it's not as simple as I recognize the law is wrong, because you can recognize the law is wrong, or what you're doing is wrong, but if you feel that the spirituality is overriding that, then that's what you're going to go by in some cases.
You know, it's an interesting observation I hadn't referenced in the show since we've been covering this case. It's what her appearance has been throughout this. But since we're talking about the mortal sin aspect and the Catholicism and the impact of that on the jury, I thought I'd mention it. So I noted, but no one's mentioned online that I could find, you know, this is typically what she looked like during jury, and that is, that's a cross she's wearing. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty prominent throughout. And it looks to be, you know, like an Irish collada type cross. I always get my names messed up, but, you know, which is a Catholic looking symbolism, you know, and the mother-in-law. So I was very curious in my mind once we were having this conversation about this, whether the prosecution, again, intentionally brought that up to illustrate to the jury, without having to say it to the jury, the dichotomy sitting before them of Christian faith and killed her babies, you know, and so should burn in hell, you know. So without even having to say those things, because of how she presents and just bringing up that topic, it plants that seed. Because again, I picked up on what she was wearing as that from the very beginning, because to me, any kind of wobble of anyone strikes and that, it struck me. But no one's even covered it. So I was just kind of curious whether that was like that one of those subliminal things that was just planted as every little nugget they try to do. Anyway,
you know, on that very briefly, one possible theory from the prosecution is that they knew that this doctor was going to talk about with Lindsay Clancy whether this was a mortal sin. And then if they got it from somebody who is not experiencing any mental health issues like the family member, and the family member would have said, yeah, that is a mortal sin. And then they would have compared that, if Lindsay Clancy would have affirmatively said to her medical providers, yes, I do think it was a mortal sin, the prosecution could say, hey, this same person is looking at this the same way the defendant is looking at this, because they are both legally sane on this issue. That might have been an approach.
Yeah. You know, in other words, planting a seed to build from.
I'm curious about that exact topic, Eric, because let's just take a step back out of the trial here for a second. There's a lot of businesses out there, especially in the South, where they will use a cross within their marketing of like their logo, whatever. It's like, you know, Tufts Plumbing. And they're like the T is a crucifix. I find it to be a little shitty. I think it's like I don't know that I necessarily trust somebody who's throwing that into their marketing material and it's not an ulterior motive, but I'm sure there's some that are being, that's just, they're living their life and that's, they like to put it into everything. Could it also backfire? I mean, what's been your experience in a courtroom when obviously the way one dresses, the way one presents itself to a jury, that's important. But when you start to mix religiosity into it and you start wearing crosses or whatever, things that somehow signal to a jury some level of religiousness in a case that so many people are looking at and just going, this is evil. Could that backfire? Could that also, could you have jurors that are going to look at her wearing a cross going, blasphemy? Look what you did to your children, and you have the audacity to wear a cross in here? I mean, I can see it playing both ways, depending on how someone is coming into it with their own preconceived notions.
Oh, I think so. And you know, an analogy might be jurors do not want to feel like they're being duped. They do not want to feel like they're being manipulated, especially in such a high stakes thing like this. So like, let's say there was a personal injury case and the trial happens 3 years after the car accident and the person is injured, but they go into the courtroom with like a neck brace on. Well, typically you wouldn't have a neck brace 3 years after such an issue. You might have a surgery, you might have something else, but and the juror might look at that and be like, hey, they're trying to sell me something. They're trying to dupe me on this. I think those same risks apply to a person going in there with a cross and saying, you know, are trying to convey perhaps that they, you know, do have some holy purity and devotion to their faith and things like that, because they're trying to engender sympathy from that jury. A jury might look at that and say, hey, you offed three kids. Don't try to tell me you're some nun in here. And I'm offended by that possible suggestion.
Yeah. I mean, all those things matter. Whether, yeah, you know, what one's intent is can be misinterpreted easily by someone else. But it all matters. And so it's all a weighted, weighted exercise, if you will.
I think she brought everything. I mean, again, my interpretation of what she wore, what she brought in there, what she had in front of her throughout this was meant for her own stability throughout this thing, for her own comfort. It wasn't meant for signaling anything. But again, regardless of that fact, it has an impact on the jury. And I'm curious what Reddington thought of it.
Eric, it's now in the hands of the jury. Next time we talk, we'll probably have a verdict, I would imagine. This may air, but and there may be a verdict before we even get this out. Outside of the live, where do you think it lands?
My apprehension is, I think the most likely outcome is a hung jury. Yeah. I think that this is such a polarizing case. It has divided the world, the country, the state, everything. And you better believe those divisive influences can loom heavy back in that deliberation room. I think a hung jury is most likely. I think the second most likely outcome is that she is not criminally responsible. Third most likely is that she is guilty of manslaughter. And the least likely outcome is the prosecution's going to win on that top charge of murder.
How long do you think till we get an answer?
This is not going to be like a quick one and done thing. It's not going to be like they all go in there and, we all kind of feel the same way. Let's get this done before lunch. No chance. I think we're looking at multiple days, possibly a week.
Who knows? How long will a judge allow for deliberations? Is it up to the judge pretty much? How long could this go, do you think?
It is basically up to the judge. And I'll tell you, after too much time has gone by, both sides might be going to the judge. Hey, we got to check in with these folks. Are they going to reach a determination? Are they even close? And the judge in many states can check in with the jury and they can say, hey, guys, it's been like 2.5 days. Do you think you're getting close? Are we making progress? Are things deadlocked? Something else. And so the judge sort of has to monitor that. It cannot be in definite. And I've seen judges say, hey, after, and they give instructions saying, hey, you guys, your job is to reach a verdict. Please go back there. Please reconsider your positions. Please do this. Mm-hmm. But if that doesn't happen, the judge can call it as a mistrial at some point, or a hung jury, at some point, if there has not been a termination after a reasonable amount of time.
The judge can make the call when we're done after a certain amount of time. And it doesn't have to be the jury saying, we can't figure it out. They can be going on for a week and a half. And if they're still not there, the judge can be like, I don't think you're going to get there. So I'm going to call it, basically.
Usually the judge would need some indication from the jury that they are gridlocked or that they are practically gridlocked.
Okay.
I don't think if they checked in with the jury a week from now and the jury's like, hey, we're moving along, we're just getting through stuff, I don't think the judge is going to call it under those
circumstances. Sure. As long as there's progress being made.
Right.
All right. Anything else, Robin?
No. It was, as always, Eric's got an amazing insight on all these things as we keep peppering him with all these and all these random thoughts that enter my mind as we're talking about these things. So thanks, as always, Eric.
Always a fascinating conversation, an important one today as the closing arguments come down and it goes into the hands of the jury. Your thoughts in the comments section and Substack and YouTube. If you want to go back and listen to any of the testimony in the case, you can do so on the podcast. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and find the audio you'd like to listen to. And you can listen to that testimony start to finish, whatever you're doing, wherever you are at. So be sure to check that out. All right. We'll keep covering this. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I am Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.